Good morning. It is 8:15, and I'm calling to order the House Committee on Fraud Prevention and Agency Oversight. We have a quorum present, and Vice Chair Anderson, would you move the minutes of February 17th?
17th, hard to believe it's getting late, almost out of February. I move approval of the February 17th minutes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you. And today I would like to welcome to the committee the Acting Commissioner of DHS, Shireen Gandhi. Thank you for being with us. She has been in this role maybe 2 weeks, if I'm thinking about it correctly, but she's been a longtime person at the department, so deep knowledge, and we look forward to your testimony today.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. For the record, my name is Shireen Gandhi, and I'm currently serving as temporary commissioner for the Department of Human Services. I have been at the Department of Human Services since 2017, serving in various roles, including Chief Compliance Officer, Assistant Commissioner, and Deputy Commissioner. I came to DHS from the private sector with 22 years of experience in healthcare public affairs, working for providers, namely hospitals, nursing homes, surgical societies, and trade associations. A significant portion of my career has focused on quality of care, process improvement, and compliance. At DHS, I led the creation of a compliance oversight structure in order to help improve compliance and strengthen our internal controls. Now, this work is work that is never done. It is, you have to take it with a continuous improvement mindset. And so at DHS, I continue to champion process improvements and strengthening our internal controls. And I look forward to working with this committee as long as I am serving as temporary commissioner. Minnesota is a state that is committed to helping people, and we're committed to providing services that improve the lives of Minnesotans. Early childhood programs provide valuable education to Minnesota's children and serve as the workforce behind our workforce. They provide care for children while their parents go to school and work. Fraud in these programs is unacceptable. It is not a victimless crime. It hurts the people who need our services, and it erodes public trust in government. People who steal and misuse public dollars should be held accountable to the fullest extent of the law. DHS takes seriously our responsibility to monitor for noncompliance and prevent, detect, and investigate fraud. We are always continuously improving how we approach supporting and protecting these programs. Today, I'd like to cover for the committee how we operate now, because it's important to start with accurate knowledge of our program integrity work and DHS's often unknown successes. I also want to cover how the state has continued to strengthen its approach to program integrity in early childhood programs over the past 5 years, and the governor's recommendations for this legislative session. DHS prevents, detects, and investigates fraud in early learning programs, namely the Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP, which helps families pay for child care so parents can work, go to school, or look for employment, and the Great Start Compensation Support Payment Program, which supports child care and early education workforce by increasing compensation and benefits to recruit and retain this vital workforce. Since stepping in as temporary commissioner, I have been meeting with OIG managers, with the DPS commissioner, Bob Jacobson, and Superintendent Drew Evans. We have a strong team in this state and are eager to do more. Currently, there are about 1,800 licensed child care centers and about 5,800 licensed family childcare providers. About 3,600 providers are enrolled in CCAP. Sorry about that. Okay. Let me know. Is this better?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Every year, licensing conducts annual unannounced visits to child care providers. While licensors are not CCAP investigators, they do report directly to CCAP when they observe conditions or violations in the program that are suggestive of fraud or other CCAP program violations. Whether it's an obvious sign of fraud or errors in record keeping, licensors are trained to report these findings to CCAP for review and possible investigation as warranted. On-site visits made by licensors, these make a difference by assuring direct accountability, and we also use tips received and information from our data analytics program in order to determine when investigations are warranted. Since 2020, the Child Care and Investigation Unit has recovered $2.4 million. Since 2021, they have referred, on average, about 5 cases a year to law enforcement for criminal investigation. And since 2021, they have stopped payments to 79 providers.
If I could interrupt you just for a moment. And members, feel free, this is a longer presentation, so if you have questions, just notify us and you can jump in. So I just wanted to follow up on this slide before we move on. Of the cases where they have stopped payments, how many of those were referred for criminal investigation?
Chair Robbins, we would need to get that number for you.
Okay, thank you. And then were there any changes in licensure in those? Were they put on suspension or revocation or anything? I'd also like to know, you know, what's the threshold at which you stop payment? And, you know, in those instances, if you could give us more detail on that.
Yeah, I would be happy. I mean, in terms of this specific 79, we would need to go back and look at the records and determine what we can share. But in terms of stop payment, I can give you that information now.
Perfect.
The threshold. Okay.
Yeah.
So under state law, DHS can only act to stop or end CCAP payments if the provider is operating after receiving an order of suspension, revocation, or decertification. If the provider intentionally gives false information on billing forms or submits false attendance records, if there's a credible allegation of fraud, if the provider refuses access to attendance records. And I think I cover that also a little bit
okay.
later in the presentation.
I might be getting ahead.
Okay.
Thank you. That's helpful context. Appreciate
thank you.
It. Oh, and Lead Pinto has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and actually I'm seeing maybe you'll end up getting to this, but just the there's a reference to referral to criminal investigation in the slide, and then there's also the Child Care Audits and Investigations Unit. And just understanding to what extent is the unit looking only at criminal fraud cases versus are there other kinds of situations where payments may be stopped besides criminal fraud? Just sort of understanding the scope of the unit and what part of it is fraud or criminal fraud versus other things going on, if that question makes sense, Chair and Testifier.
Ms. Gani.
Chair Robbins, Representative Pinto. Yes, the investigations unit can take a number of administrative steps, and I'm going to cover those as we move forward. And then they also, if they see, if they believe there is fraud present, will refer it to law enforcement for further investigation and prosecution.
Okay, I'll leave it for now. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
So, when DHS receives concerning information about a provider, it goes through this workflow. And I thought this might be helpful for the committee to understand the process that we use in our Office of Inspector General. So the first step is that there's an internal or administrative inquiry process to evaluate the concern. If it's determined a crime may have been committed, the case is referred to law enforcement for further investigation. If it's not clear, then a civil or administrative regulatory examination continues. For investigation, if it's not clear a crime has been committed, but there's problematic behavior, a full civil investigation begins. This examines the behavior in relation to our program's rules, regulations, procedures, and the statutory framework. If at any point in this process the investigation uncovers criminal activity, then it is again referred to law enforcement for further investigation and prosecution potentially. If there's improper conduct, but it's not criminal conduct, then the Inspector General pursues appropriate civil remedies. If the case is referred to the criminal investigation to the BCA, it'll be presented for possible charging by a prosecutor at the end of the investigation. And that does not prohibit our office from additional civil remedies. So going a little bit deeper on fraud investigations. Criminal fraud is defined as the intentional deception of a person or entity for monetary or personal gain. DHS has ongoing relationships with state and federal law enforcement to prosecute fraud. Investigations are based on tips, complaints, and data analytics, which allow DHS to take a risk-based approach to focusing its resources on investigations. When DHS finds suspected fraud, it refers the case to the BCA at the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, a law enforcement agency, so that they can conduct a criminal investigation. And DHS also works with federal law partners such as the FBI.
Excuse me, Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. I had a question. So you said earlier that when this occurs, when there's suspected fraud, that you can cut off the payments. Mm-hmm. And do you do that mm-hmm. right away? Do you cut off the payments right away when there's suspected fraud, when a case is referred?
Yes, statute we are allowed to for credible allegations of fraud.
Mm-hmm. But do you typically do that?
I think we, Madam Chair, Representative.
Yes,
Yes, so it's a case-by-case basis made by looking at the facts.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Anderson. And to follow up on that, so of the number of cases that are referred for a fraud investigation, how many do you stop payment on, or have you stopped payment on in the last year? Of the ones that have been referred for a fraud, credible allegation of fraud, how many have you stopped payment on?
Let me see if I have that data.
Do you have that? We've got the 79 stop payments.
Yeah, I have the number of the 79 payments, but it's specifically the way that you're asking for the data to be looked at, I don't have that number handy.
Great.
But I can get it for you.
Yeah, if you'd follow up. Great. Thank you. All right.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So back on slide 4, you said that you'd recovered $2.4 million. When you say recovered, do you mean you actually went to those agent or went to those daycare providers and got money back, or you just stopped payment?
Recoveries are getting money back. And then there's also, in addition to recoveries, there's avoidance of ongoing payments. That's a separate category.
Representative Rarick?
Thank you. Maybe I need to move. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so you've actually, so I'm assuming that was through a criminal process because you wouldn't have the power to actually go in and empty their bank accounts or anything like that. So can you let me know, I know that the chair asked the same thing kind of about how many criminal investigations there have been, and you talked about it going to the BCA, but have you sent any to the FBI or some of our U.S. attorney folks here, you know, the ones that we're dealing with, Feeding Our Futures? Has anything from the CCAP crossed over into Feeding Our Future?
Ms. Gandhi.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think I'm going to try to keep track of the several questions there. Starting with the Feeding Our Future, since that case broke, our team has been taking all of the information that we are able to get and making sure to look at those individuals, make sure we have all of the right identifying data to have the right person. And then we've looked in our programs, both CCAP and the Medicaid program, in order to see if any activity was taking place in DHS that was concerning. And so far, we have not found any activity that we were not already watching and taking action on. But we continue to evaluate that. And for and because of this process and the ability to take action when there's credible allegations of fraud, currently we have stopped payment to 55, disqualified 26, and also revoked some license holders.
Thank you. Representative Varek? Thank you. Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're in the House building. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have a question as we're thinking sort of to scope back out. We're talking about both sort of citations for noncompliance, we're talking about fraud. Can you give a sense of the whole panoply of things you might be looking at, where sort of when we talk about referrals to criminal fraud, how much of that is in the scope of the entire things you spend looking at for child care centers or for CCAP centers?
Ms. Gani.
Chair Robbins, Representative. Yes, on average, when we look at concerning issues that come up, about 80% are noncompliance or administrative investigations. About 20% get investigated further for fraud.
Thank you. All right, let's continue. Thank you.
Chair Robbins, member of the committee. So I believe we were here on referrals to the BCA.
Yes.
So when we refer a case to the BCA, if the BCA accepts the referral, they conduct a criminal investigation into the suspected fraud. DHS investigations and BCA investigations typically occur concurrently. We are looking into the compliance matters and the BCA into criminal matters. DHS can take administrative action like stopping payments and disqualifying the program. The BCA then works with county attorneys to prosecute cases of fraud if they're able to build a case that's strong enough to prosecute.
If you wouldn't mind, I'd like to interrupt just for a second. When I was reviewing the OLA reports from 2019, there were two BCA investigators embedded in DHS. Is that still the case, or are they separate but you refer to them?
Chair Robbins? They're not embedded. Yeah, so I'm told that they're no longer embedded. I know that we do fund investigators in the BCA for the CCAP program.
And do you know why that change was made to not embed the BCA, continue to keeping two BCA officers within the child care investigative unit?
Chair Robbins, I have a colleague that does know the answer to that.
Perfect. Thank you very much. If you would mind stating your name for the record. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Tom Johnson. I'm the Deputy Inspector General for the Program Integrity Oversight Division at the Department of Human Services.
Great. So my understanding is there used to be two BCA officers embedded with the Child Care Investigative Unit, and that is no longer the case. Can you explain how that transition took place?
Yes, absolutely, Madam Chair, members. That change took place in 2018 or 2019 when there was a decision to make a clear separation between criminal investigations and administrative investigations. DHS is the administrative investigative agency. The BCA is the criminal investigative agency. So we work very closely with them, but they're no longer embedded. DHS pays the BCA to staff the investigators in their agency.
Thank you. Lee Pinto.
And thank you, Chair. And actually, I'll just note, since I was around in 2019, I recall that at the time we funded two additional BCA investigators. Maybe this is what the commissioner was referencing, to be working with DHS, but put them at the BCA. So I don't know if that might have made four investigators then total. But anyway, just sort of, Madam Chair and members, I recall that was one of the things that, that we did in 2019 was to have dedicated BCA resources then to, or additional resources to work on this, but then that way they're working with other agents at the BCA. Anyway, thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. My understanding is BCA generally, in this case too, is more criminal rather than financial fraud. And that's their specialty, really, is a criminal. And so, and maybe that was part of the logic here, I'm not sure, but because they're two different things in many cases. So is that to the, I don't know if we get your title again, but my question is to you, is that your understanding too?
Mr. Johnson.
Thanks.
Chair. Oh. Chair Robbins, representative. I just want to clarify that financial fraud can be criminal as well.
Well,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, you're exactly correct that the BCA is a criminal law enforcement investigative agency and DHS is administrative. Mm-hmm. That was the reason for the clear split.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that clarification because I was also going to say there's actually lots of criminal financial fraud, and one of the things that might be useful in this context is one of the changes that the governors did was actually consolidate a lot of the financial fraud from Commerce and at the BCA. So one of the things that might be useful to look at is some of those questions of how fraud, from a criminal perspective, financial fraud is dealt with through the BCA. That might be an interesting thing to look at because I know it's been a topic of lots of the conversations we've had, misclassification fraud, some of the financial fraud that overlaps with this stuff. So think just as we talk about it.
Great, thank you. So just to be clear, there are no longer BCA agents embedded in DHS, but you work with two or four dedicated agents. Which number is it?
Madam Chair, DHS has a contract with the BCA. We pay them to fund four investigators. They are no longer embedded with DHS.
Great. Thank you for clearing that up. Thank you. We can return to your testimony, Ms. Gunn.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. While DHS works closely with our law enforcement and prosecutorial partners, we also take administrative actions for noncompliance, as we've been discussing. We take administrative actions for all program integrity violations. Our administrative actions include warnings, correction orders, stipulated provider agreements, monetary recoveries, fines, payment withholds or stop payments, suspensions, and disqualifications. Addressing noncompliance and fraud begins with prevention. The Early and Often program was established by bipartisan legislation in 2019 in response to the OLA's reports on CCAP fraud. It provides technical assistance to new programs and ensures earlier program integrity oversight than in the past. New centers receive 4 visits from their licensor during the first year of operation, with joint licensing and CCAP investigator visit in the third quarter, including an attendance record review. The first licensing visit is an announced technical assistance visit. Subsequent licensing visits are unannounced. If there are violations, a correction order can be issued or another action can be taken, including referral for further investigation. Moving along the continuum, the DHS-OIG Licensing Division licenses center-based and family child care services across the state. Licensors conduct annual reviews and investigate complaints to determine compliance with Minnesota laws and rules. Licensing protects the health, safety, and rights of those receiving services by requiring that providers meet minimum standards of care for the physical environment. Examples of licensing functions include health and safety protections, overseeing capacity and ratios, ensuring facilities have adequate physical space for healthy learning, checking to make sure staff have completed the required training, and cleared background studies. Licensors are often the first eyes on the program, and they may see things that are concerning and refer that for investigation. The OIG Child Care Audits and Investigation Unit identifies, prevents, and investigates fraud and compliance with CCAP. The ultimate goal of this work is to protect taxpayers and families participating in the program. We may take administrative action, as we've discussed, and refer credible allegations of fraud to law enforcement.
Thank you. Representative Rarick.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Gandhi, I was just wondering, so during COVID, we were told that in-person visits were suspended, and so when did you return to actual in-person visits, not over the phone, because I'm told that over the phone is another substitute for actually being in-person to visit, which is odd, because I don't know how you would see all those violations over the phone, but when did you actually return to in-person visits, not just over the phone or Zoom?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Madam Chair, we'll have to get that for you. I don't have that date.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rarick.
So, Commissioner Gandhi, are you currently doing in-person visits, not just by Zoom or over the phone?
Ms. Gandhi.
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. And Madam Chair.
Representative Rarick, sorry.
Thank you. It's hard for me to see you. Yeah, I might have to move to a different chair. Was it in the last maybe year or 2 years that you returned to that? Because I know during COVID you weren't doing that. And the reason I ask is Jay Coles, you know, did an interesting story and went multiple times to different daycare centers that were receiving quite a bit of money in the millions. And, you know, there's video, go looking through windows where it doesn't look like there's been a daycare center there ever. So I'm just wondering when, you know, after this year is done, you said in the first year you made the first visit is announced and all the other visits are unannounced. And I don't know if that's in person or over the phone or over Zoom, but has it been a year or two or less than that you've actually returned to physically in-person visits, not over the phone and not by Zoom?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative, I don't want to give you an exact date because I don't want to give you the wrong date. I would like to get you the correct date. But it has been a while that we have been doing in-person visits, and I am familiar with the J. Cole story. I know that our licensors have conducted unannounced visits to those centers that he's talked about, and there were children present on each of the occasions that we went. We've also talked with the reporter about the proper location and door to use to get to the center. And so we have not had the same experience that reporter had, and we've shared what we've seen and the accurate hours of operation and doors to access the facility with the reporter.
Madam Chair. Representative Rarick.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Well, we'll just have to revisit that. So the other question I had is you talked about data analytics to find fraud. Can you expound on that a little bit? What kind of data analytics do you actually use?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, representative. Data analytics can include things like billing amounts, any of the data points that we collect on centers. I would want to be careful about listing everything, and I don't know all of the details of what's behind it, but we use the data that we have to look for anomalies, to look for correlations, look for data that might be more indicative that something is concerning and we need to look more closely into it. What's helpful with data analytics is it is not, it's based on data. So it's another avenue for us to focus our resources where we're most likely to have a problem. So it rounds out the information that we get from tips and from licensing.
And question. Last question, Representative.
Yep, last question for now. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so then when you received all that data back and you got people analyzing it, what happens with the employees that do point out fraud? What's the next step after the employee brings it to their supervisor and they say, I think I see fraud, then what happens?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, representative. Then I would go back to that slide where I say we've identified a few slides ago, we identified that there is something concerning. Then it is handed over to our investigations unit. Or it's actually first we look at it, do a review and assessment to see if there are concerning items that weren't further investigation. And then it'll either go down the administrative route, the criminal investigation route, or both.
Thank you. Please continue with your testimony.
Okay. This slide shows the collaboration that we have across systems at DHS and with our local partners. So our early and often team, as I just discussed, works closely with applicants for child care center licenses and newly licensed providers, offering technical assistance to reduce errors, increase compliance, and strengthen program integrity. Sorry about that. It's a little, I don't see either of the screens up here. Next, OIG licensing. The licensure establishes oversight to support child care being provided in a healthy and safe environment by qualified individuals, and that care meets the needs of all children in their care. Licensing staff check for compliance and have a range of actions to take for non-compliance, including referrals to investigations. Child Care Assistance Program Provider Investigations Unit investigates and takes appropriate action if child care providers violate rules or laws relating to the state's program. Actions include administrative remedies to stop and recover payments and make referrals to law enforcement agencies for criminal matters.
Ms. Gandhi, if I could interrupt you on that
yeah.
point. Earlier, Representative Rarick had talked about how you recovered the $2.4 million, and I wasn't exactly clear on that. Could you restate how you recover the money from a provider? Mr.
Madam
Johnson.
Chair, members, yes, we recover funding in various ways. If the provider is continuing to operate, we issue a monetary recovery and we reduce their future payments in order to end up collect the amount that we've received. If the provider is no longer operating in CCAP, then we issue a monetary recovery order and ask them to pay.
Thank you. Could you elaborate? If someone has been, there are allegations, credible allegations of fraud to the point that you're recovering money, why are they allowed to continue to operate?
Madam Chair, thank you for that question. We don't continue to pay. If there's a credible allegation of fraud and we stop payment, there are no future payments going to them. In that case, we would just issue an order asking them, requiring them to pay us back the money.
So what would be the scenario where you are recovering it from them and they continue to operate?
Madam Chair, members, yes. Those would be the providers that fall into the 80% of not fraud. It's 80%. There are compliance issues, program integrity issues. An example might be they are actually serving kids, but they're not keeping adequate attendance records. There's no suspicion that fraud is going on. They're serving kids. They're getting payments, but we do a monetary recovery to because of the noncompliance for attendance record keeping.
Thank you. That's helpful. But presumably, if they're not keeping adequate attendance records to the point that you need to recover money, you find that that's not fraudulent. It's just bad record keeping, but yet they're being overpaid, correct?
Madam Chair, correct. There are cases where they just aren't good at keeping records, but there is no suspicion they're not actually providing services. So that would not raise to the level of fraud and criminal investigation. But administratively, we would recover money for noncompliance. Excuse me, for noncompliance.
Great, thank you. And to that point, how do you verify attendance? So I know they keep the records, but rereading the OLA reports from 2019, it seemed like there was an effort where people would be billing for the enrollment amount, but no one was really verifying if that enrollment amount matched physical children showing up every day, or that the days were just given for like a month or two at a time, and nobody really checked where the kids actually showing up. So can you talk about how you verify 10 kids are showing up every day, or, you know, maybe a child is there for 5 days and then the next week 4 days? How do you nuance that?
Madam Chair, yes, thank you for the question. We use various investigative techniques. One is doing the unannounced visits to see are there actually kids here. We also use surveillance mechanisms, cameras basically, to see how many kids are entering each day. We then, over a period of time, we compare those video records to what they billed. And that is typically how we identify cases of actual fraud, where they're billing for services that were not provided.
Thank you. And are those surveillance tools used only in cases where fraud is suspected or more broadly?
Madam Chair, members, it's used more broadly to sometimes start an investigation. We don't know if it's fraud or if it's something lesser, more of a noncompliance issue. So we use the cameras to help us determine, is there fraud happening? So it's used before we determine there's actual fraud happening. It's one of our main tools for identifying fraud, actually.
Great, thank you. And I know there are people who have questions. I wanted to just turn to Mr. Johnson. I think, did you have some thoughts on the recapturing overpayments that you wanted to share with the committee?
Madam Chair, members, I think it's largely been covered at this point, but there was an earlier question about recovery going always through a criminal matter. That's not required. There is an administrative process that the agency can follow. They have a statute that describes what they can do and what actions they can take, and that can include what was just described in terms of issuing orders to recover money.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And I had one follow-up question on the attendance piece. Do you use an electronic check-in system, or is that something generally required of providers?
Chair Robbins, that is in the governor's budget recommendation.
Thank you. It was also in the OLA recommendations back in 2019, so that's something that I think people have been seeking for a long time. Thank you. Let's see who's else on the list. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was just trying to get a concept of this recovery money. So how much CCAP was paid out since 2020? Because you said you recovered $2.4 million, which is about $600,000 per year, which is very small. So how much was actually paid out since 2020 in CCAP money?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, I would need to get a calculator and do the math, but the program is around, it has gone from, I think, around over $200 million to over $300 million a year, both state and federal share and local share.
Great. Okay.
Just to follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Rarick, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're talking about an infinitesimal amount of money recovered if you're paying out $200 to $300 million per year, and you've recovered about $600,000. And some of that apparently is just a reduction of future payments. And then you said something about you actually like send a bill back or something to the CCAP agents or providers. Who actually pays you back? Not just pull back from future payments, but who actually pays you back? And again, that's only $2.4 million in 4 years when you're paying out $200 or $300 million per year.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative, we have stop payments. We have prosecutions that require payment, and in order for me to tell you what we've received back over all of the same years that you're asking for, I would need to go back to the team and pull additional data for you.
Madam Chair, I think this is important. I mean, it was from their slide, Madam Chair, that, you know, since 2020, they've recovered $2.4 million when they're paying out $200 to $300 million per year, Madam Chair. That just seems like an absolute drop in the bucket. $600,000 per year of recovered money, and most of that is probably just not paying future payments. It's just infinitesimal, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue with your testimony, Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, thank you. So the next item on this slide that I want to just mention as part of the pieces that work together are our OIG Data and Analytics Office, which analyzes the provider service and billing data, recipient benefit data to identify unusual patterns and outlier service provisions. The BCA, as I mentioned, refers cases of suspected fraud. The OIG, excuse me, refers cases of suspected fraud to the BCA, and they conduct the criminal investigations and work with prosecutors. And then also DHS works with counties to investigate recipient fraud. So we've been talking about this a little bit already, but there are a range of violations that take place. So licensors conduct annual unannounced inspections of licensed child care programs as required by the Child Care Development Fund. The inspections can occur at any time during the calendar year. They review the space, the policies, procedures, and records for compliance. Licensing violations may be for a variety of non-compliance. There are items such as cleanliness of the program, having equipment in disrepair, not maintaining child staff ratios, not following medication administration, or behavior that is not in line with policies and procedures. Some licensing violations are referred for further investigation to the Program Integrity and Oversight Division. These situations can include missing or incomplete attendance records, no staff or children present when a licensor attempts to conduct an unannounced visit during the hours when the center is approved to operate, and when the program is operating outside of designated days and hours. An example that easily meets the criminal definition of fraud would be billing and receiving funding for services that are not provided. Uh, As we covered a little bit earlier, DHS does not have the authority in Minnesota law to stop CCAP payments to a provider just because they do not meet licensing requirements. If a provider's license is active, licensing violations alone do not affect their ability to receive payments.
Ms. Gundy, if I may interrupt on that. So I find that a bit confusing. So you do have the right to stop payment when there's been a suspension, a revocation, or some other suspicion of fraud. So if they have serious license violations, why wouldn't that lead to a suspension or revocation that could lead to stopping payment?
So you just, Madam Chair, you just said serious licensing violation, and it's important to look at the facts of a violation to determine the nature, the severity, and the frequency of it. So licensing violations alone don't mean that there's fraud in the program. However, they can catch our attention depending on the circumstances of the violation and have our investigators look more closely into it. So a licensing violation could be something, could be given for water on a bathroom floor, a plastic bag stored on a low shelf where children can reach it. Those wouldn't be things that would rise to credible allegations of fraud and have us stop payments.
No, I understand that. Okay. I wasn't suggesting that all license violations mean fraud. What I'm suggesting is, I'm trying to get to is, at what level of licensing violation is it severe enough so that you would suspend or revoke a license or even put them on a conditional licensing status? So internally, since it's not spelled out in statute, you must have sort of benchmarks or thresholds where something rises to a serious violation that would trigger conditional licensing, a suspension, a revocation. So could you explain what that internal metric is?
Chair Robbins, if I'm following you, I believe the second bullet and sub-bullets cover what you're asking. So we can withhold or end CCAP payments if there's a credible allegation of fraud. If they're operating after receiving a suspension, revocation, or decertification, if they intentionally give us false information, or they refuse to let us access attendance records.
Right, I understand that. So what would lead to that second bullet? What rises to the level of suspension, revocation, or decertification?
Chair Robbins, maltreatment would be one example.
Anything else?
I can, Chair Robbins, I would be happy to go back and get a comprehensive list from our OIG legal counsel.
Thank you. I would really appreciate that, because one of the things I did in preparation for this hearing that I believe we sent to you, perhaps, was we pulled a list of the top CCAP payments from last year where they got over $1 million. So these are just the top group. There's a whole lot more under that, but we just thought, let's look at the ones with $1 million in CCAP payments in 2024. And there were many with serious violations. And the two that J. Cole visited that you seem to think are okay had serious violations. And one of them had 36, one of them had 95 violations. And some were more serious than others, but another one had their conditional license. They had their conditional license for 2 years, and then it was just reinstated last June. So I'm very concerned that serious license violations are happening, but it's unclear by your own admission what rises to the level that would require suspension or revocation So understanding that for the committee is very important, because if we're paying out millions of dollars just in the last year where they have dozens of violations, I don't know what it takes to rise to the level then of suspension so that these payments are stopped. So, and clearly you keep saying, oh, statute doesn't require it, statute doesn't require it. So I'm actively looking at things we should do in statute to strengthen your authority to do that. So, but I need a little bit more clarity on your current process for getting to suspension, revocation, or disqualification. So I know you'll get back to me on that, but I just want to say that this is sort of the nub of what we're trying to get at here. So I really appreciate follow-up on that for the entire committee, not just to my office. Thank you.
Chair Robbins, so the licensors look at, as I said, the nature, the severity, and the frequency of the violations. We work to be very thoughtful and careful about about maintaining access to childcare where there aren't serious violations. If we want to make sure high quality childcare is provided, and most of our providers do provide high quality childcare. The licensing violations, like we were discussing, can be can have a whole range of seriousness and frequency. And so the licensors look at each individual situation based on the facts. When a entity is put on a conditional license, that allows for more frequent visits, more checks by the licensors, and more technical assistance to help that childcare provider come into compliance. Again, this is for our hardworking, honest, upstanding childcare providers who are doing their very best to serve the children of Minnesota, and we want to be there for them, helping them to do that. When we have a bad actor that is not complying and not working to improve the quality of care or improve compliance with our requirements, attendance records, billing, et cetera, then we take more severe action.
Great. Thank you for that answer. I appreciate that. Do you know how many child care providers currently have conditional licensing status?
Chair Robbins, I do not.
Okay. It would be helpful to know that. Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate this as somebody who does not sit on these committees and think a lot or understand a lot about how we license childcare centers. It occurs to me that we're talking about a set of things. When we're talking about licensing violations, oftentimes the problem you're trying to fix, right, is not a problem that withholding payment is the right solution. So paperwork violation, some safety violations. On the other hand, when we're talking about fraud and we're talking about overbilling or whatever else, that is probably the best tool. So I guess it feels like we're sort of, when we talk about, and I will openly say, this is not the committee of jurisdiction and I don't sit on it, but when we talk about the problems we're trying to fix for licensing, and we talk about folks with a suspension or revocation or decertification, for those licensing issues that are not fraud, what tools do you have to actually fix the problem? And then when do you decide, like, we're not trying to fix the problem, what we're actually trying to do is either shut down the center or make sure that folks are going someplace else?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative. The list of tools that we have are warnings. We have correction orders and technical assistance to help the provider come into compliance. We have stipulated provider agreements. And then if it's a financial matter or for non-financial matters, we can also issue fines. We can have monetary recoveries, payment withholds. We can also have suspensions, conditional license, temporary immediate suspension, and disqualifications. So those are the range of administrative actions.
Yes, follow up, Representative Greenwood.
Thank you, and I appreciate that because I think the goal, our goal should be to make sure that we're using the right tools to fix the right problem. And so when we have issues of fraud, right, we're not trying to fix that, we're trying to shut that down.
Right.
When we have issues of non-compliance, and we all know, and I think we hear from the other side, that there's oftentimes too much that we're requiring people to comply with, but whether it's paperwork, whether it's safety violations, whether it's all sorts of things, we want to make sure that we're using the right tool to get the right result. And so I can imagine that stopping payment, if what we're trying to do is fix the safety violation, actually might make that problem worse. So just as we think about it, and as we think about our committees of jurisdiction, it feels like when we talk about fraud, we want to make sure, one, we're detecting that as soon as possible. We're going through the process where we're covering those resources and we're shutting down the centers. When we're talking about other things and really making sure that our committees of jurisdiction are focused on it, that they have the right tools to fix the right problem, but wanting to make sure that when we have a hammer, everything doesn't look like a nail. So appreciate this conversation.
Thank you. Commissioner Gandhi, please continue.
Chair Robbins, members of the committee.
Timeline slide.
Okay. Payment withholds.
Oh, I already did that.
Did I cover that? Did I cover this?
Yeah.
Okay. Next slide. Okay. This slide shares the journey that we've been on to enhance program integrity in the child care assistance program. We have to apply a continuous improvement mindset as our environment is always changing, new tools become available, and the strategy of bad actors gets more sophisticated. In a slide, here's a high-level look at our milestones. In 2019, the legislature passed and the governor signed into law CCAP integrity improvements. Also in 2019, the cross-divisional early and often team was funded. 2020, the OIG completed a continuous improvement project. I believe that was something Chair Pinto was referencing earlier. In 2021, the OIG created a data and analytics team to better help DHS detect potential non-compliance and potential fraud for further investigation. In 2023, the legislature passed and the governor signed enhancements to limit on public funds statute, including allowing the state to temporarily withhold payments based on credible allegations of fraud involving any state or federally funded program. In 2024, a coordinator was hired for limit on public funds, and today I'm here to ask for your support for the governor's requests for a comprehensive anti-fraud package and electronic record keeping. Before we get to our 2025 package, I want to provide a little more detail on the enhancements we've made over the past 5 years. In 2019, we've strengthened administrative sanctions by expanding the use of administrative sanctions to quickly stop payments, issue disqualification notices to non-compliant providers, and close or terminate CCAP registration for non-compliant providers. Enhanced record-keeping requirements by clarifying what's required on attendance records and creating a methodology and tool for overpayment calculations. Added more prevention measures for provider oversight through the early and often team, developing a change of ownership process for license holders, and researching the electronic record-keeping tool, which is now requested in the governor's budget. and strengthened our work with law enforcement by updating contracts with the BCA and funding additional BCA agents to investigate fraud.
Representative Schultz, excuse me.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So on this slide, I've just kind of been curious. When you are reviewing all of these records and then hopefully providing oversight, to what extent do the staff at your agency pore over the reports that are sent to you?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative, can you say a little bit more about reports sent to us?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking here at this slide and just the record keeping and the reports that are required when people are receiving these dollars. To what extent is your staff reviewing the information that's given to you and really digging into the data?
Commissioner Gunn.
Chair Robbins, Representative. We have a data and analytics team that is helping to look at that at a large scale, and then we also have our unit that will look at anything that is flagged or seems concerning based on a tip, a complaint, a licensing visit, in order to determine which items to look into further and investigate.
Representative Schultz.
Madam Chair, when I'm hearing what you're saying there, I'm hearing that you need an additional tip before you are able to identify within your agency, based upon the review of the reports that you're given, to really dig into something deeper. Is that accurate?
Commissioner Gunn.
Chair Robbins, Representative, that is not accurate. That is part of the story. The data and analytics team that is able to review the records that comes into us is another piece.
No further questions.
Thank you. I had a question, just going back to an earlier discussion we were having. When you talk about the record-keeping requirements, currently, are you paying for the number of enrolled children and then verifying that those number of children come to the daycare or the child care center, or do they submit records of who came for the two-week period? And based on who physically attended, they are paid. Which way does it work?
Chair Robbins, I would like to check with our team to find out specifically the process and the steps in the correct order.
Great, thank you. I think that's very important because the OLA report on internal controls from 2019 flagged that as a real problem, that payments were just going out based on the number of children that they were enrolled or had capacity for. And based on that, that drove most of the overbilling that we saw back in that era. So if that is still the way payments are being processed, that would be a big concern and something I think we would want to change, whether through statute or through agency policy. Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and I believe this is correct, that the payment is currently required to be made based on actual attendance. Well, I guess we'll find out about kind of mechanically how that works. I believe that there's a federal rule that's gone into effect that requires the payment be made based on enrollment, which I'll just point out in all this discussion, we always want to compare to K-12 education, right? You know, our school districts don't have to sort of count each child when the child shows up, that instead it's based on enrollment. But I believe that that's correct, but the agency I know will correct me and provide more information, Madam Chair. But I think that's the case. It has to be based on attendance. And I know that there was quite a lot that was done in 2019 and then since to kind of make sure to shore up these systems have been discussed. So thanks.
Great. Well, I just look forward to that follow-up. Thank you. Please continue.
Chair Robbins, while Representative Pinto was sharing what he understands to be true, I received confirmation from the Department of Children, Youth, and Families that that is correct.
I'm sorry, can you restate it? What is correct?
That we pay based on attendance.
You pay based on attendance, so they submit the number of kids who've been attending, or it's sort of a list every 2 weeks or every month? Is it a reimbursement model or is it forward-looking.
Chair Robbins, I'd like to ask Jennifer Sommerfeld from DCYF to come up so that she can provide that.
Terrific. Thank you. Ms. Sommerfeld, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Robbins. Members, my name is Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm with the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And yes, we pay based on enrollment. I have to go back and verify the billing cadence, but I believe it's monthly. The bills go to counties, is my understanding, through MAC Squared, and it is the counties that work through the payment process.
Thank you. So contrary to what Commissioner Gandhi just stated, she said it was based on attendance. You just stated it was enrollment. Can we clarify that for the record, please?
Yes. It's based on attendance. My apologies. I said the wrong thing. Yes. Representative Pinto was correct, though, that there is a federal rule requiring payment based on enrollment.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you for clarifying. Please continue, Commissioner Gandhi.
Oh, thank you, Chair Robbins, members of the committee. Continuing on, diving a little bit more into a couple items on the timeline, this slide talks about the 2023 enhancements to the limit on public funds. The state took additional action to expand agencies' ability to go after bad actors with less red tape. The legislature passed and the governor signed into law enhancements on the limit on public funds. This expanded DHS's authority to take action against a provider based on actions taken by DHS and other state or federal agencies. We know there are bad actors who cross program areas, and this expanded our authority to take action based on that. We can withhold payment based on credible allegations of frauds in programs administered by any state or federal agency, or suspend, disenroll, or exclude providers from a DHS program based on another agency's credible allegation of fraud or pending investigations. This also provided funding for a limit on public funds coordinator and one training position. The second training position has been allocated to DCYF. So this year, the governor's budget includes comprehensive multi-pronged proposals to strengthen the state's ability to prevent, detect, and address fraud in human services programs.
Vice Chair Anderson.
I have a quick question. On the previous, the 2023 limit, were these added in statute? Strengthen limits to receive the ability to withhold payments across agencies, or was just something that the agency did internally?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, representative, this is the recommendations for the 2025 budget.
I'm sorry, she's looking at the slide where it says 2023 limit on public funds enhancements. Commissioner Gandhi.
Apologies. Chair Robbins, representative, can you state your question again?
Thank you. Were these the expanded ability and added ability, this the bottom left and the top right, were these things that were done internally at DHS or were these things put into statute? How did this happen? That's my question. Thank you.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, representative, they were addressed by the legislature.
Mm-hmm. In statute?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, statutory changes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, and Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly, just so that I have a little bit better context. So how many employees are there in the CCAP division? And secondly, you've been talking about the data analytics team multiple times. How many is the team? Is it two people? I mean, how many people are on your data analytics team? And then if you'd answer that, and then circling back. So if there was 200 to 300 million per year since 2020, that's over $1 billion worth of CCAP money that's gone out, and you've recovered 4 million out of probably $1.2 billion.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, representative. I believe that our CCAP program has about 25 staff in it. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Please just say your name for the record again.
Madam Chair, members, Tom Johnson, Deputy Inspector General at the Department of Human Services. Our CCAP investigations team has four investigators and one supervisor. Our early and often, early and often team has four investigators and one supervisor, and our grant audit team has four auditors and one supervisor. And there's a manager for the unit as well.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. So I'm confused then. So you keep talking about a data analytics team. So who's the data analytics team? So you've got fraud investigators and a super, four and one, a supervisor, four and one, and a super. So who are you talking about when you keep talking about this data analytics team?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is the OIG data analytics unit, and they are a unit that does data analytics and does systems work for us as well, data and systems. So there's a team within the OIG that serves the entire OIG.
Great, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So really quickly, so how many are in that team? And so they serve like all of DHS or all of state government, or like how far reaching are we talking about, like DEED and DALI and all of state government, or?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, they serve the OIG. Excuse me, at DHS, only the DHS OIG. And I don't have the number of staff on that team, but we can certainly get that for you.
Madam Chair, I think that would be really important because we've been talking about this data analytics team nonstop, basically as the reason why they don't have fraud. And we don't even know how many people are. Is it one person? Is it 10 people? Or is it 20? I don't know. We don't know. So I think this is a really important point, Madam Chair, that we get back.
Yes, I look forward to getting that answer. Thank you. Thank you. And was there someone else? Yeah. Lee Pinto, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And so just following up on the questions about the 2.4 million recovered and then the size of the program. And of course, part of the reason the program is the size that it is because there's tremendous need. And we know that even the program as it is not meeting the needs of Minnesotans for early learning and care. But could you just talk about, I'm just trying to put the 2.4 million in context. Is there a number that you've tried to recover and then have been, like, how does the 2.4 million compare with the amount that you've identified as being that you'd want that should be recoverable and yet has not been? I don't know if you have that information now, but if you understand what I'm asking.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative, we would have to go back and gather that information for you.
Okay. Yeah, if they could do that, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. We'd all appreciate hearing back from you on that. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just kind of following the line of questioning from Representative Rarick, I mean, even if you don't have the exact number for us, we would even find just a minor amount of solace in just knowing a range. Are we talking about, to her point, are we talking about a handful? Are we talking about 10 people? Are we talking about 100 people? Because I think ultimately when we get down to it here, we're talking about, are people reviewing reports? Are people doing site visits? Are people getting into the details as to whether or not there's fraud in these instances? And that's what Minnesotans care about. Minnesotans care about whether or not we are actually diving into the data. I think that plenty, especially on our side of the aisle, have been worried about people showing up for work. And we want to know, are there even people that are doing this job? So can you please give us even a range of what the number of employees? I totally understand that there are people who come and go and leave certain parts of state government, but can you please give us a range as to the number of people who work in this space?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative, I appreciate your drive and push for the facts. Facts are very important to me, and that heartens me because we are happy to get you the facts and to continue to work with you. Once we have the facts at hand, I think then we can decide what more needs to be done in this state to strengthen program integrity. Overall, our Office of Inspector General has 406 people in the licensing division, 91 in the Program Integrity Division, and, you know, more than a few handfuls in the data analytics. It depends on how you look at the data, but I think it's somewhere around 40, but they might fall into different categories of doing more than one job. But I would be happy to get with you on that so that we can determine how to, what we're doing now, what's working now, what you want us to do differently in the future so we can keep the integrity of this program high and we can serve Minnesota's children well.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate this conversation. I think when I think about what Minnesotans want, they also want to ensure that our kids, our youngest learners, have access to care and that that care is provided. I know that Representative Pinto talked about there being folks who need care and don't get it. When I think about fraud, I think the most important thing what we're doing here is making sure that we're protecting and ensuring that Minnesotans have access to the care. I mean, in this case, our youngest learners have access to the care that they're legally entitled to and that we as a legislature and as a state have decided to provide. And so to me, that is really why we need to root out fraud, is that we are focused on those kids and those families that need it and deserve it. When we think about the data analytics, and I think that's sort of the question we've been asking, I know that there's both people, there's also technological tools. And again, this is a place where we have seen the governor and the governor's budget, and I hope we'll hear and be able to hear those pieces, because I think that they have been in response to the conversations that have been having over the last couple of years in the legislature. And so I feel like there's a lot of foreshadowing, but particularly in the area of how do we use the tools. We know that fraud is a business model that is out there, not just as it's targeting government, but that it is targeting families, it's targeting seniors, it's targeting everyone. And so as we think about what we're trying to look at and really solve and what government tools government need, we really need to really understand that business model. A piece of that is the data analytics, a piece of that is the people. And so I look forward to that conversation with all the tools we can bring to bear to ensure that our kids get the care that they need and our families do too. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. I would just like to say that I agree with the concern that, you know, we are talking about fraud and we are also talking about needing childcare for families in Minnesota. And we are the Fraud Prevention and Agency Oversight Committee, and the agency oversight part deals with licensing violations as well as the criminal fraud case, and both are very important. So I appreciate this conversation. I appreciate the partnership we want to have with the agency to make sure that Minnesotans' child care have the slots available, but also more than the slots, that it's a safe environment. And we'll get more to that. But please continue with your governor's recommendations.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Agree and appreciate this committee's support and interest in this topic. So the governor's package includes increased staffing in the agency's program integrity and oversight operations to increase the capacity to investigate alleged fraud. For every dollar we spend on an investigator, we have an average return on investment of $1.89. This means that every dollar spent on an investigator results in $1.89 of revenue or cost avoidance. Cost avoidance would be, for example, preventing improper payments from being made. The figure is based on actual data from the last 5 years, and revenue includes monetary recoveries, fines, and restitution from criminal conviction. We also are asking for increased staffing in our program integrity and provider eligibility and compliance unit to strengthen controls on the front end for provider enrollment, which helps prevent potential fraud from occurring, and increase staffing for our internal controls audit investigations unit. Mm-hmm. The governor's package also includes statutory licensing, payment withholds, and data sharing that clarifies our authority. We want to make it easier for agencies to share data so that we can take action faster. We want to expand authority to immediately suspend a program's license if a controlling individual, not just the license holder, is criminally charged with offenses such as fraud or theft. Allow for payment withhold when there is a criminal conviction related to fraud involving another state or federal agency. Allow for payment withhold when a license is revoked or suspended by DHS or another state or federal agency. And allow for payment withhold when an entity or associated individual has a background study disqualification.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. So are you, Commissioner, are you saying that you don't have the authority to prohibit kickbacks right now and that you don't have the authority to or payment withholds when there's and suspension or, and you have, is that what you're saying?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, representatives, this is expanding and making it easier and clarifying our authority. So allowing this to take place, allowing us to take actions when some of these activities are happening in other agencies. So we have some ability, but not as much ability as we would like to be able to take action.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like the information as to why you don't think you, you know, why you don't think you have the authority for this now, especially on some of these things, kickbacks, when there's fraud in one government program to not be able to do something other. That would be good information. I think the whole committee would be interested in that. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Gandhi. And I would also note one of the things you just stated is that it was for program suspensions, but we've already discussed at length that you can stop payment when there's a program, when there's a suspension of a license. Is that different than a program suspension?
Chair Robbins, my understanding is that we're looking to broaden so that if these things are happening in other state or federal agencies, we can take action. As for the kickbacks, that is a federal rule, and it's my understanding that we do not have the authority in state statute to take action based on that.
Ms. Gandhi, I would say that, you know, we're happy to also work with you on clarifying the statute on that. Certainly that's important. That was one of the big issues back in the 2019 OLA report where they flagged kickbacks of $200 to $300 per person in some of these cases. And so this has been something we've been well aware of since 2019, and it's stunning to me that the work on internal controls has not fixed this yet. And it also seems to me that if there are credible allegations of fraud is one of the triggers for allowing you to stop payment, and a kickback certainly would rise to the level of credible allegation of fraud. So I don't know why that's not already subsumed under that. Could you comment on that?
Chair Robbins, thank you. We very much appreciate your interest and support in this. We had a bill last session that did not pass and would be very happy to work with you again, or in 2023 session, excuse me, and would be very happy to work with you on that this session.
Great. Could you just elaborate more specifically why a kickback doesn't rise to the credible allegation of fraud? Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, yes, kickbacks are illegal under federal law. There's nothing in state statute that prohibits kickbacks. Yet we hear and see the kickbacks are happening in a variety of sectors, including healthcare, Medicaid, human services. So they're happening, and there's nothing we can do about it. We've brought the bill several times, and it has not passed in the past.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. So why does a kickback or evidence of kickbacks not constitute credible allegation of fraud?
Chair Robbins,
I
believe that it would, you know, I think that we're getting into legal rationale and reasons, and so that's something that if we could explore further with our attorneys and provide you with information, we would be happy to do that.
Thank you. I would appreciate that, because to me, I get that it might be a federal statute, but still, we have a general blanket authorization for you to stop payment when there's a credible allegation of fraud, and I think kickback would certainly fall within that. Representative Rarick.
Thank you. So help me understand this. So you just said, I think, that it's federally illegal to do kickbacks, but you can't stop it here in the state of Minnesota because it's not illegal in the state of Minnesota. So if it's federally illegal and you're getting some money is federal money coming through Minnesota in all kinds of different forms and fashions through DHS, billions and billions of dollars come from the federal government. Help me understand why we think here in Minnesota that we can't stop kickbacks when it's federally illegal to do so. Help me understand that.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative, I believe the issue is that we are not able to prosecute it effectively.
Representative Rarick.
Well, DHS isn't going to be prosecuting it, but you certainly can turn it over to your federal partners, the FBI and others, just as what happened with Feeding Our Futures. And, you know, I remember a decade ago when there were, and I talked to somebody who literally saw this at the airport, there were suitcases full of millions and millions of dollars, and we couldn't substantiate for sure how many hundreds of millions of dollars came out of CCAP, but there was at least some. And that was a decade ago. So now you're saying that we know that we have kickbacks. We have kickbacks pervasive in state government. There is a federal law prohibiting it, but we don't have the authority to stop it here in Minnesota. I don't understand how those two can be in the same sentence. Madam Chair, I don't understand this at all. Like they already said they have relationships with the FBI and others. It was pervasively throughout their presentation, and yet we know that there's kickbacks. We know it's federally illegal, Madam Chair, and yet we don't have the authority somehow to stop it. I don't understand this, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rick. So, Commissioner Gandhi, maybe if you could just respond to the part about working with your federal partners and why that's not happening, because that is a violation of federal law, even if not state law. And then I'd like you to finish up the presentation. So a quick response, Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins. Representative, I would like to ask Director Johnson to answer the question, but I just want to clarify that, you know, there's the ability to prosecute federally and state. And so if we were to clarify and we were to put into law similar in Minnesota to the anti-kickback statute, that would give our prosecutors more tools to go after this on a state level as well. It doesn't mean that we aren't going after it on the federal level, and I'd like Director to speak to that.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the question. We work very, very closely with multiple federal partners, including the FBI, Health and Human Services, OIG, and the Office of the U.S. Attorney on issues where we see kickbacks. The good news is, good or bad news is, when a provider is giving kickbacks, they most likely are doing other program integrity violations, up into including fraud. We have authority under state law to take action on many of those things. It's just the kickback portion under state law, we have no authority to take any action. But that's not saying we're not doing anything. We work very, very closely with our federal partners, FBI, Health and Human Services, OIG, and the Office of the U.S. Attorney on issues like kickbacks.
Thank you. I appreciate my colleagues want to jump in here. Let's keep it quick because I'd like her to finish her presentation. Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so I did want to just get into that distinction. Maybe one thing is just if we could define, we've been using the term kickback, but I don't think anybody's actually defined that term. I don't know if that's correct for the testifiers or forget who brought that up first, but just briefly confirm that.
It was in their slide.
In the slide, yeah, okay. So then maybe our testifiers can do that, Chair.
Mr. Johnson, would you want to define kickback for us?
Madam Chair, Representative Pinto, members, kickback, very generally, this is not a legal definition, is when a provider offers an incentive to someone to provide services. So we see things like a provider saying, send your kids here and I will pay you X amount per month. Come to my, send your senior parent to our adult day and we will pay you X amount per month. Even if those services are provided, that is a kickback under federal law and prohibited. Worst case scenario is they pay the people for access to that person's billing and they bill for services are provided. In those cases, we do take action at the state level. We can refer them to law enforcement for fraud, state law enforcement, whether it's the Office of the Attorney General or the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, can investigate and prosecute. It's just the kickback portion that the state level, we have no authority to take any action.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. I'll just
last
note.
One,
yeah. Thank you. So, no, of course. So I'll note. Yeah, to my mind, the gap is that state level criminal prosecution. So illegal under federal law, you can take administrative action, and my understanding is that you very often do. The challenge, if you want a criminal prosecution at the state level, that's where I know as a prosecutor, that having the elements be very clear. This is an area. Even as you described it, I thought to myself, you know, sort of you're going to do business with private business, and oh, where there's going to be some kind of bonus. Well, how do you define exactly what's a kickback, what's not? That gets complicated, and so we want to make sure to have that tool for state-level prosecution. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, just continuing on the same line, I'm not the lawyer in this group, but I know that, for example, Representative Greenman and I have been working on basically incorporating aspects of federal antitrust law into state law, specifically because, you know, if the feds don't have the resources or the indication to prosecute these cases, then we need explicit authorizing language in our statutes to allow our AG to bring the cases. And I think that's what we're running into here as well, basically, is that if it's, you know, simply a violation of federal law but not state law, then the feds can bring a prosecution but may not have the resources to do it. But by putting it into state law, it gives us the explicit authority to pursue them as well.
Thank you. Yep, let's just finish the presentation. Thank you. Commissioner Gandhi, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Background studies. So addressing increasingly complex fraud cases effectively requires coordinated use and authority and regulatory tools across DHS. Language changes in 245C14 and 245C15 will enable DHS to disqualify people under active investigation for fraud from working in programs serving children and vulnerable adults that have access to billing and from receiving public funds. A new background studies disqualification would prohibit an individual who is under active investigation for fraud from holding any position involving ownership, management, or control, or billing activities in the program for which the background study is conducted. New authority will enable DHS to disqualify people under active investigation for fraud from working in programs serving children and vulnerable adults. For the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, the governor's budget invests $5.4 million in fiscal year 26-27 and $2.8 million in fiscal year 28-29 to enhance program integrity at DCYF. It includes $4.9 million and $2.9 million in 28-29 for the implementation of a statewide electronic attendance record-keeping system for CCAP. It's not only necessary infrastructure. This is not only necessary infrastructure needed to implement other changes required by a new federal rule, but it also supports program integrity and fraud prevention. Once complete, the system would provide the state with data on attendance, in programs in a consistent and timely manner. The current practice is often manual and varies by local agency. This would provide a standard across all agencies. A similar effort for electronic attendance record keeping is currently in process for early learning scholarships. The Department of Children, Youth, and Families is in transition. They were established July 1 of 2024, along with a well-planned and thoughtful transition of staff to DCYF through June 30, 2025. I want to mention that the OIG functions that will be transitioning toward the end of this year are listed here on this slide. And in closing, I just want to reiterate the DHS remains committed to our responsibility for monitoring noncompliance in our programs and rooting out fraud. Through strong oversight, our OIG helps to protect the health, safety, and financial integrity of this program. DHS works to prevent and detect fraud as quickly as possible. We investigate any credible evidence of noncompliance and fraud, referring criminal actions to law enforcement for investigation. And I would be remiss if I didn't emphasize and applaud the vast majority of child care providers who provide high quality care and education to the state's children. They are the valued workforce behind the workforce, allowing parents to go to work and to school and to look for work. They should be commended for the work they are doing, and we have to be careful not to overburden them as we target the bad actors. As I've mentioned, successful program integrity requires a continuous improvement mindset built on a thorough understanding of the facts and where we are today. And we look forward to partnering you as we move forward this session to continue to make this program stronger.
Thank you. In conclusion, I just want to go back to one thing that has stuck with me that has been bothering me. So we were talking about what rises to a suspension or a disqualification so that you could stop payment. And on the violation side, and I know you'll get back to me with what the different thresholds are, but the only thing that you cited was maltreatment. And that very much concerns me. So I wondered, when you are looking at what leads to conditional license, what leads to suspension, what are those factors? Like, is it the background check issue? Like, ideally, I'm honestly stunned to hear you have in your list of things that you can't suspend someone who's under active investigation for fraud, that's not already possible for you to disqualify. But in terms of safety for children, background checks for staff, electrical outlets not being tamper-proof, medication procedures not followed, unsanitary conditions, infant bottles not being labeled. Those are things, when I go on your lookup, you have a website, the DHS licensing information lookup site. It talks about all those violations. All of them in the ones that we're paying $1 million to or more, and that's just the ones I looked at over the weekend. So there are multiple serious violations going on at all of these centers. And I get they're not all just paperwork. I get that some are paperwork and we can deal with that. But there are serious health and safety violations going on. So to me, as a mom who used to have kids in childcare, I would think those rise to serious violations that would at least lead to conditional licensing or suspension. So could you help me understand, like, is it, how do you get there? And how can parents, when they go on your DHS lookup website and are looking at their child care center or other child care centers they're considering, how can they have comfort in understanding that all these violations are being adequately looked at? I mean, a once a year visit for some of these things maybe isn't sufficient. Please respond. Sorry, that was a lot.
Chair Robbins. thank you. Thank you for your concern, and I think all of us that have children and have had children in childcare want that assurance that the quality of care is happening. And our licensors, and I would like to ask our director to come up to discuss it in much more detail than I can. However, what they do is they provide correction orders and technical assistance. The most important thing for our well-meaning child care centers is to have them and support them in providing the quality of care that we need for our children. However, when that's not possible, additional steps are taken. And Chair Robbins, I'd like to have Director Dotson discuss that. She heads up our licensing division.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Glad you are here.
Thank you so much. My name is Alyssa Dotson, and I'm the Deputy Inspector General for the licensing division that oversees the licensing compliance. We have multiple tools as licensors that we can use to address violations when they occur. So when the licensor is on site, there may be things that the licensor is providing kind of technical assistance in the moment to say things like we had mentioned before, there's water on the floor, is a slipping hazard. The licensor would ask that, hey, can we wipe that up? And can we address that right now so that doesn't continue? If they are issued a correction order for any violations, the licensor is following up to make sure that that program has come into compliance then. They may order additional corrective action in order to come into compliance with these, such as I think you had mentioned if, like, infant bottles are not labeled, the licensor wouldn't wait until the next annual review to double-check that. They follow up with the provider to make sure how have you come into compliance with this to make sure that that risk has been mitigated. So at times they are addressing it immediately. If there is something so serious that it poses a imminent health and safety risk to the children, then we have tools that we can come in and we could issue things like a temporary immediate suspension to interrupt services and shut down that program immediately because there was an imminent risk of harm while the investigation is ongoing into what was going on. More so than just maltreatment, we can issue a conditional license, a suspension, a revocation for licensing violations as well. For each of these, we look at the kind of what the severity of the violations are, the frequency of how often they are happening, are these repeat violations, or the nature of kind of what type of violation it is as well. And each of these scenarios is so nuanced and so complex that it's not as easy to say this type of violation equates to a conditional license. We look at the history of the program, the compliance of the program, whether they, sometimes the programs have self-identified and corrected something before we even get out there. It's still a violation, but it's already been corrected. That's different than a program that we've asked for a corrective action and they have not come into compliance with that corrective action. So for each of these, we look at kind of the specific violations, the nature, the frequency, the kind of severity of those violations, and then have different actions and tools that we can take from there.
Thank you. So there isn't sort of, and I get everything is very nuanced, and I appreciate that you do not just wait till the next yearly visit to follow up on some of these things. Absolutely. But to that point, so serious violation seems to be the trigger, but yet we're still struggling to find out what constitutes a serious violation. So do you have some sort of rubric based on frequency or severity that kind of leads to severe violation, or is it just up to each licensor who goes on these inspections?
There's not a rubric that equates to this type of violation equals a conditional, again, because of those nuances in there. So a licensor is coming back and they're discussing that with their supervisor or with the manager of that unit, and we're driving towards a, you know, kind of some sort of consistency within that as well. So it's not up to each individual licensor necessarily. They will discuss those with their supervisors. And for each of those, what might, you know, everybody has a different definition of what severe might be in there. And so just by saying a severe violation, we want to get to what is the impact on the children in care? What's the impact on their health, their safety, or their rights? And that helps drive us to what that severity of that license is as well. Again, using the example of the water on the floor that was cleaned up, that's been mitigated and that risk is not ongoing, versus if you might have a staff person or several staff people who have never had a background study, the program did not complete a background study, for those staff, we could order that those staff are immediately removed to remove that risk as well. So we have different tools that we can take based on what the violation is.
Thank you. That's very helpful because I struggle, honestly, with what we need to put in statute and what we need to just know that there are nuances and you guys need to figure out. But on the one hand, I'm hearing, oh, well, we need to have kickbacks in statute. I'm like, really? Like, why isn't that already covered, right? But maybe we have to put that, or that you say you don't have enough authority. But then on these background disqualification things, it seems obvious to me that that should already be in place, and yet apparently that's not ongoing. So I look forward to future conversations because I really think we want to put things in statute that really strengthen your ability to enforce and provide great childcare in Minnesota. And yet there is a tendency to micromanage to the point that it's really hard. So I think we need to find a way to make sure you have the statutory authority you need, but then you need to exercise it. Because my concern is that there's a host of things that I think to the average person would rise to serious violation that seem to not be getting there. So maybe some sort of a rubric of at least training for your staff so it's uniform on what rises to serious violation might be something we could work on together, because I think parents have an expectation of the quality of the childcare and for the violations we're seeing or not. And I'm sorry, we are out of time. I'm 1 minute over. Forgive me. The committee is adjourned. We look forward to it.